From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. Deconstructing Dinner is currently heard weekly on 32 Canadian stations and many more around the world. I'm John Steinman. On today's episode, we'll cover a wide range of topics, but all of them share a common thread, and that is that they are all about successful and innovative farmers producing uniquely flavorful foods. Launching the show, we'll travel to Vancouver Island, and more specifically, the community of Courtney, which is home to Natural Pastures Cheese Company. The small business produces an increasingly popular line of cheeses available throughout British Columbia, and the success of the company is proving that it is indeed possible to successfully produce cheese while maintaining strong social, ethical, and environmental values. We'll then move up the road to DKT Ranch, where Dan and Maggie Thran have diversified their farm to incorporate a growing yet controversial solution to struggling farmers, agritourism. And then we'll head off of Vancouver Island and onto another, Salt Spring Island, where in September 2008, correspondent Andrea Langlois attended the Salt Spring Island Apple Festival. Andrea met with Harry Burton, one of the festival organizers and an avid promoter of red-fleshed apples. That is, an apple that is either green or red on the outside, but red or pink on the inside, not white. And you can stay tuned for that and more on today's broadcast of Deconstructing Dinner. If you miss any of today's broadcast, it will be archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the December 11th, 2008 broadcast. Also, a reminder that if you are not yet subscribed to our weekly podcast, which is an online version of our weekly radio show, you can do so by linking to our podcast feed, also posted on the site. And for those of you who have not yet thought of a unique gift for your family, friends, and coworkers during the upcoming holiday season, you could choose to make a donation to the Deconstructing Dinner Radio Project, and we'd be happy to extend a thank you to a person of your choice, either online or through the mail. Donations are an important tool to help keep this program on the air, and support of our efforts results in no wasteful packaging and produces no negative social or environmental impact. Instructions on how to donate and give Deconstructing Dinner as a gift can be found on our website, again at deconstructingdinner.ca. Now, before we meet with those behind Natural Pastures Cheese Company, I do have a short and personal story to share with you that is cheese-related. Now, as is probably no surprise to those of you familiar with the content of this show, I, for one, strive to eat a diet that is as local as possible and carries with it the least environmental, ethical, and social impact. And so, of course, one of the outcomes of trying to maintain such a diet is that inevitably, I consume very little, if any, processed foods. That is, food that comes in maybe some form of packaging, and foods that often contain ingredients that cannot be pronounced and or understood. And another outcome and downside of this diet is that the options available at restaurants become pretty limited. And as a result, I don't eat out nearly as much as others do. And when I do eat out, it's almost always at restaurants whose values correspond with my own, or whose practices in the kitchen I know to be responsible. Now, as for food safety, this is a pretty safe diet, because hardly any of the foods that I choose to eat originate from within the industrial food system, a system that is breeding the ongoing stream of food recalls that we hear about almost every week. And so if all of these factors are put together, and if I did choose to dabble in some processed foods or perhaps enter into some unknown run-of-the-mill restaurant, I think it's pretty fair to suggest that statistically, I should have one of the lowest chances of suffering from a case of food poisoning. I'm never exposed to the highest risk foods in restaurants, and so therefore run a pretty low risk of coming down with any foodborne illness. And so there I was just a week before this show now goes to air in a small community here in British Columbia when I was invited to do dinner with a group of people who I was visiting with. Now, being a small town, the restaurant options were limited, and the options to be picky with what to eat would have all but led me to go hungry. So I put my food philosophies aside and placed the social importance of sharing food with the people I was visiting as the priority. Once I sat down and looked through the menu, I decided that my safest bet was to order a pizza with tomatoes, olives, and cheese. My pizza arrived, I sprinkled some Parmesan cheese on it, and devoured about half of the pizza and took the rest back to the bed and breakfast I was staying at. Now, I'm not going to mince words here because what happened next needs to be shared exactly as it unfolded. Because I spent the entire night puking out every last bit of food that I consumed that evening, all of it, and did so on about five occasions for a prolonged period of about 8 hours. Between the vomiting, I lay in my bed, I trembled from the chills that were rushing through my body, and as I lay there in between trips to the bathroom and being unable to sleep, I of course had time to think. And I think the most important thing I said to myself that night was, "This is it. This is exactly why I choose to sit here in front of this microphone once a week and share with all of you what is wrong with our food system and what we can all do either individually or collectively to ensure that our food is safe, healthy, and responsibly produced. Because if someone like me, who likely possesses, like I said, one of the lowest chances of contracting a foodborne illness from a restaurant, can indeed walk in to a restaurant and walk out sick, well, something is no doubt wrong with our food system. Now, you're probably wondering what it was that caused the illness, and I've pretty comfortably concluded, based on what other people at the table ate and did not eat, that the culprit was the Parmesan cheese that was sitting on the table in one of those standard shakers. And of course, this isn't some revelation of new news that our food system and restaurants are not safe. The problems with our food system are discussed constantly here on the show almost every week. But what my food poisoning incident did do was further fuel my own efforts to continue to share with you what the mainstream media fails to, and that is why our food system is unsafe and how we can all go about being part of the creation of new food systems. So you can be assured of many more in-depth investigations and reports into 2009 as Deconstructing Dinner proudly heads into its fourth season of programming. Keeping on the topic of cheese, but now hopefully reinvigorating your trust in cheese, as I know this next story does for me, we arrive in Courtenay, British Columbia, a community located at about the middle of the eastern coastline of Vancouver Island in what is known as the Comox Valley. In October of this year, I attended the annual conference of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation, where about 150 agricultural journalists and communicators from across the country converged for a couple of days of tours and a day of speakers and panel discussions. One of those tours was to Natural Pastures Cheese Company, a small business whose cheese I had long appreciated after first tasting their products a few years ago. The story of Natural Pastures is an inspiring one because it's a story of how one farming family was able to preserve the heritage, social, and environmental values of their dairy farm by diversifying into becoming a commercial cheesemaker, who now distributes their cheeses throughout the province. Natural Pastures now sources their milk from a number of traditional farms on Vancouver Island, including one farm that raises water buffalo. While most of Natural Pastures' cheeses are made with cow's milk, they are the only cheesemaker in Canada producing a variety of cheese that uses the milk of water buffalo. In this next segment, we'll hear from Natural Pastures President Edgar Smith, head cheesemaker Paul Sutter, administrative and distribution manager Leslie Shan, and Monty Python's John Cleese. And that's right, Monty Python.
Morning, sir.
Morning. I was sitting in the public library in Sermon Street just now, skimming through Rogue Harry's by Horace Walpole, when I suddenly came over all peckish.
Peckish, eh?
Esurient.
Eh?
Yabber-all-only-like.
Ah, hungry.
In a nutshell, so I thought to myself, a little fermented curd will do the trick. So I curtailed my Walpoling activities, sallied forth and infiltrated your place of purveyance to negotiate the vending of some cheesy comestibles.
Come again?
I want to buy some cheese!
Ah. Well, it was an interesting story for ourselves. My brothers and I are third-generation farmers on Beaver Meadow Farms here in Comox on Vancouver Island.
Edgar Smith, President of Natural Pastures Cheese.
And we have produced dairy products and had a dairy farm since the 1950s, we got into certifying our farm so that it was a certified heritage farm, one of the first ones in Canada. And all our milk is produced from pastures and that have no pesticides or herbicides or GMOs or chemicals added to the soils or the animals. And we had this wonderful quality milk, but it was just going into the normal Class 1 milk sales for fluid milk. We belong to a cooperative here on the island, and the cooperative that processed and marketed our milk got into financial difficulty and was bought out by our dairy company from Montreal. We thought that we would not have a home to process our milk. So with the assistance of the provincial government and ourselves and three other dairy farmers, we did some market studies on Vancouver Island, what would be an alternative way of marketing this special type of grass-fed, quasi-organic milk. And all the answers pointed to artisan cheese making. That's how we started. None of us were cheese makers. We had been in the dairy industry for three generations. So we obtained a cheese maker via New Zealand and South Africa to get us started up with some used equipment. And once the plant was operating, we then obtained the services of our master cheese maker from Switzerland, Paul Sutter, who remains with us today and makes all our artisan cheeses. Since we started in 2001, the sale and marketing and range of our cheeses have just continued to grow every year since then.
Down a little bit following the route we came in, and then up a big hill that goes up toward Northbound College. We go a little ways up there, we'll turn onto what's called the back road, and we'll climb up and we'll have a good view of Courtney in the flats. On a clear sunny day, you'd get a view of the Courtney Glacier, which is directly behind us, sorry, Comox Glacier, and some of the mountains in the background.
So here we are. We're going to split into two groups, okay? And the most important concern this morning in the next few minutes as we get in is just with respect, you've been to a farm and we're going inside a production facility, so if you're getting a pair of boots and we say step in the sanitizer, please do that. It's important. We'll all be getting you to wash your hands, wearing the hairnets, and you're going to look great. So can I take the first half of the bus, please? Split yourself.
About half.
Once we get in the front door, I'll come back and get the other half of the bus.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Natural Pastures. My name is Leslie Shan. I'm the manager of Natural Pastures Cheese. While you're waiting to go out into the production area, I'm going to take you into the shop for a tasting. So, follow me. We've been in production for 7 years. In the first 10 months of production, we were lucky enough to take out 3 gold medals at the Canadian Cheese Grand Prix. They went to the Boracas, the Camembert, and the Verdelais Cumin Seed. Since that time, we have also taken out a gold medal at the same competition for the cracked pepper.
Now, my good man, some cheese, please.
Yes, certainly, sir. What would you like?
Well, how about a little Red Leicester?
I'm afraid we're fresh out of Red Leicester, sir.
Never mind. How are you on Tilsit?
Never at the end of the week, sir. Always get it fresh first thing on Monday.
Tish, tish. No matter. Well, 4 ounces of Caerphilly then, if you please, stout yeoman.
Ah, well, it's been on order for 2 weeks, sir. I was expecting it this morning.
Yes, it's not my day, is it? Belpaese?
Sorry.
Red Windsor?
Normally, sir, yes. But today the van broke down.
Stilton?
Sorry.
Gruyere, Emmental?
No.
Any Norwegian Jarlsberger?
No.
Liptauer?
No.
Lancashire?
No.
White Stilton?
No.
Danish Blue?
No.
Double Gloucester?
No.
Cheshire?
No.
Any Dorset Blue Vinny?
No.
Brie, Roquefort, Pont l'Evêque, Port-Salut, Savoyard, Saint-Paulin, Carré de l'Est, Boursin, Brest Bleu, Pelle de Champagne.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and a segment on Natural Pastures Cheese Company in Courtney, British Columbia. I toured Natural Pastures in October 2008.
This is just as we're about to go through the packaging room, and then we'll go into the aging room. If you can just do your hand sanitizer again by the door before you step through.
Okay, come on in. It'll be a little bit of a tight squeeze.
Hi.
This room is where all of our soft cheese is wrapped, the camembert and the brie. And the staff are Karen, Brenda, Kate and Chris. They can spend quite a few hours in here, three or four times a week. They're wrapping a large brie at the moment. And I'm going to take you this way just to show you.
Welcome to Natural Pastures. My name is Paul Sutter. I'm the master cheesemaker and production manager. So in here you see all the semi-hard cheeses or semi-soft cheeses we make, the different flavor, and also some experimental product going on. You know, always something. It's not that we will bring out the new product yet, but as a cheesemaker, I always like to experiment. And sometimes just one wheel, and then I end up eating it myself because it's so good. And it's not enough for everybody else, so, or the, between the staff and us. So I will get you into the make room where I make my semi-soft cheeses, and you see the equipment. I'm also in the middle of making a little batch of experimental cheese, and I can show you there.
Paul Sutter was born in 1972 in Sonnenthal, Switzerland, where he spent much of his time on his grandfather's dairy farm. In 1991, he earned his certification as a master cheesemaker, and in 1995 responded to a job posting in a Swiss newspaper and moved to Canada to become a cheesemaker here. Paul joined Natural Pastures in 2002. While visiting with Paul in his cheesemaking facility, it was clear that his passion lies in drawing out the unique flavors of the milk he uses and showcasing these flavors through his cheese. The uniqueness of his cheeses has earned Natural Pastures a wide assortment of awards, and their success is proof that there is indeed an economic value in local flavors and local food.
So the cheeses we produce in here, you've tried, is the Verdelaise with different spices in it. The Borenkaas, the Amsterdammer. We do make the fresh curd and the buffalo mozzarella. It's the only one made in Canada. You probably heard about it. And it gets made in this room here. You see different equipment behind you. You see the vat where I make the different cheeses. And it's a big one. It holds about 4,000 liters. We do about 12 to 15,000 liters a week between the two rooms we have here. And 4 days a week we produce in here, and 4 days we produce in the other room, soft cheese, Camembert and Brie. Milk's coming from different farmers in the valley who do the farming like we believed when we started up, having their own farm at that point of heritage style of farming. Gives me a great product to start, so then I can put into an artisan type of cheese where I make everything by hand and hands-on. And it just gives us the natural flavor in the cheeses you sometimes don't get anymore if they're mass produced. And if the company only produces for profit, you have a tendency to lose that because you want to have a long shelf life. Well, then your cheese can't age. It will not have a lot of flavor because as soon as you want to put natural flavors from the bacteria in it, your cheese will age. And you know, after 60 days, my cheese is too aged, might smell even like ammonia. It just, you get that, and then But I find that's the nice part about making cheese, if you can work with the natural bacteria. So what I've done here is had milk, added some bacteria. I buy them different type for different type of cheese. I usually have two cheesemakers in a special work visa from Switzerland here helping me make the cheese so we can keep up production. And then I have local guys to assist. And now I have actually a local guy who's interested to learn the trade a bit. So we train him a bit more intense. So what I did, I had the milk, I added the cultures. I added the rennet, it's a microbial enzyme. I had it coagulated, and then I cut it with the first group. So now you see here is curd and whey. And when you make a soft cheese, you have big curd and soft curd. You don't let it, you don't stir it a lot, you don't cook it. When you make a hard cheese, you make a small curd, you stir a lot, and you cook it high. That's basically the difference. The rest is, the basic is always the same. You always start up with similar temperature of coagulating and making a curdle, and then you change as you work with the cheese afterwards, what you want to produce. So for the demonstration then, when the time is ready, because what happens in here now is bacteria I put in break down the sugar into milk acid. As they break down, the curd shrinks and it settles. So what I can do then basically is just take the cheese, put it in a basket, and again, there's different way of doing it. One is just like I did now, scoop it out, or you can pump it into the forms, or you can push it together in a big block and pre-press it. And that's what I do with my semi-soft cheeses. I pre-press in a big blocks, drain the whey off, and then I cut it in blocks and put in a round mold, and I press it. And the press you see over there with the blocks, the mold, the round ones standing. So they sit there for about 2-3 hours like this. I turn them once, then they come out and they go into tank over here, brine bath for 2 days. Then I take them out and I put them on a shelf. And I let them dry off, like you see, I don't know if you noticed when you came in, we have their batch from last Monday. They're just drying off now a bit, so we can wrap them easily into the plastic. So Monday they get wrapped, they go into the mature room, and they take between 40 and 60 days to mature. And boron class, it takes up to 120 days to mature.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, where you're listening to Paul Sutter speak about his work at Natural Pastures Cheese in Courtenay, British Columbia. We often speak of the importance of genetic diversity here on Deconstructing Dinner, and often we learn of how lacking in genetic diversity our national and global food system is. In the case of dairy cows, 91% of the over 1 million dairy cows in Canada are of one breed, Holstein. But as has been shared here on the show before, there are many other breeds out there producing very different styles of milk.
They have some Guernseys. A lot of them, I believe, they have the mix. It's the Holstein background, but even then they put in different mixture of a little bit brown Swiss and all different kind. And then there's one farmer, when I get the high-fat milk for a triple cream, he has Guernsey, I think. Yeah, Jersey, there's no real Jersey farmers in the valley, but there's this one farmer who has Guernsey, and he has Simmental in it, a whole bunch of mix. I don't even study it really. I know they're red and white instead of black and white. And there's so many mixtures out there. You know, like I know the farm used to, the president, when he had his own dairy farm, he told me, to me they all looked like Holstein. But he told me I have this and this and this mixture in it, and it showed in the fat. We in school, we had to learn a bit the cows, but it was the main groups of Holstein, Simmental, Brown Swiss, and Jersey. And then, as I came to Canada 13 years ago, I just studied a bit what they have, but there's so many mix you could do, and the fact that then the way you feed them and the way you pick your breed too, you can pick through, right? It's their own process, the farmers do, and I think they're doing a great job here. So,
just as the breed of cow can determine the taste and qualities of the milk, so too does the climate. In the world of wine, the French word terroir is often used to capture the characteristics that the land and climate can lend to a wine, and terroir can also be used to describe milk and cheese. Natural Pastures President Edgar Smith.
Well, the way I interpret terroir as it applies to cheeses, it's this unique flavor and taste that our milk and cheese obtains from the soil and the nearness to the ocean, the salt-laden rain, our west coast lush green herbal grasses and herbs that take in this unique flavor. Our soils here on Vancouver Island are very young coastal forest soils. They have not been farmed for more than 30 years in lots of cases. And the glacier melted and left very rich soils along the seacoast here. Because of the lushness and the heat that we get this unique flavor. And the judges in the Grand Prix competitions said that these are flavors and that they haven't tasted in cheeses for years and years. For example, one judge came from Brittany. He recognized that seacoast flavor in our Comox Brie and Comox Camembert, which won gold and silver medals in Canada. And when we sent our Comox Camembert to the World Cheese Championship in Madison, Wisconsin, the comments from the judges were again that our flavor was unique and different. It stood out amongst other cheeses. And so we believe it's got something to do with how the salt air, the rain, the soil just seems to give a flavor to the herbalness of our milk. And I know it's used in the wine industry perhaps a little differently, but the flavors are sort of created by what the cheesemaker does from the original milk. And we believe our milk just carries this uniqueness that you can't find in other parts of Canada.
If the terroir isn't enough to diversify one cheese from the next, how's this for differentiating? Among the many cheeses produced at Natural Pastures, in one instance, the business sources a locally grown plant to use in one of their cheeses and takes terroir one step further.
One cheese that we think we do uniquely in the whole world is our Wasabi Verdelet. Wasabi is a Japanese horseradish, and it's often used in Asian cooking, sushi as a condiment. And it grows wild in northern Japan, and it's cultivated in Japan and into Taiwan. We started growing wasabi in the forest in our farm here about 15 years ago, and it thrives in the West Coast climate here with our wet soils and our unique climate that we have. So my wife, in her culinary talents, put together a recipe where we use the whole plant of wasabi, the rhizomes, the roots, the stems, and the leaves, and then we incorporate it into this wasabi cheese, which is a very neutral flavored cheese and just takes and builds flavors. Wasabi has a little bit of heat to it, but it has a sweetness, and it combines exceptionally well with West Coast seafood, smoked salmon, oysters baked in the half shell. We find that the chefs here love combining this wasabi cheese with seafood. And lately we're having artisan sake makers making rice wine and combining the sake rice wine with our wasabi cheese. And it's a combination which is probably the first in the world. Like, nobody in Japan, where they make sake, ever thought of combining it with the wasabi cheese. And here we've made the cheese for several years, and all of a sudden we have this brand new gourmet taste, wasabi cheese with sipping sake in it. It's just one of those flavors that is just unique in the world.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Now, much of this segment has been void of the politics of the dairy industry, which here in Canada can get rather complicated with the supply management model that governs all dairy production in the country. In an upcoming episode, we'll be learning more about the politics of milk and cheese when we visit with a veteran dairy farmer and rookie cheesemaker in the Creston Valley of the province. And while there is indeed much to celebrate with Canada's supply management system, after all, dairy farmers are likely the most financially successful of any sector, there are, however, some downsides. For one, if a cheesemaker who is sourcing milk from another farm wishes to pay those farmers more for their milk, they are unable to do so. And I found this out when asking cheesemaker Paul Sutter whether the farms they source their milk from are getting more for their milk from Natural Pastures.
No, because I buy it off the milk marketing board. They set the price, and for me, You know, if it would be just my farm and the milk marketing board would be out of it, then we probably could say we pay a bit extra. But the way they are set it up with the whole quota, it's impossible to kind of for me to... I mean, we got the price for cheese milk like anybody else who makes cheese.
Perhaps a system in need of reform? Again, stay tuned for an upcoming broadcast when we'll learn more about the politics of milk and cheese in Canada. You can also listen to previous broadcasts on the topic by visiting our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and selecting the dairy category on the page titled Recent. As mentioned earlier, Natural Pastures is an award-winning business, with cheese often receiving the same kind of attention that wine receives when it's judged. At the 2008 World Championship Cheese Contest in Madison, Wisconsin, Natural Pastures came home with a gold and silver in two categories. And to give you an idea of how impactful receiving such awards can be, here's the response to one question from someone on the tour who asked how much cheese the company produces.
It was us, really, all depends what, if we win an award, like we did in April, that tripled our sales overnight. And we actually knew about it before we let it out to the news. And I produced 3 weeks in advance, three times as much, and we still run out of it. So, and then we just kept on going until we had to say, we can't keep up, we just have to go back down a bit with production and fix the kinks, you know, because you're kind of pushing the button to see what you're capable of. And then you realize, I have to be a bit more careful, and until you can grow slowly back into it. And in general, it keeps up the sales. You know, I mean, it's a big vibe over a 2 month period, and then it drops back down. So, but definitely it you know, increases your sales by 20-25% minimum.
As the tour of Natural Pastures cheese came to a close, I did ask Paul Sutter if he has any new cheeses in store for the coming year. And he very strategically answered the question.
Nothing particular.
No way.
I want to put on the news. You know, I
have to kill you.
It's, you know, like I said, I like to experiment. And the beauty of it is you can actually take this cheese and you let it age with mold. You get a Camembert. You wash it. You get like a Provence. And you wash it with wine or herbs. The sky is unlimited. You can create so many different cheeses and just take the same basic. And that's all I do, is I take a cheese like a Camembert and wash it once, and just to see how it turns out. And then I take a Voroncase and wash it. And having my Swiss guys from Switzerland, when they come here for their 12 to 18 months work experience, they're fully trained, so they like to experiment. And when they see here I have the time, or I take the time, and they like that, you know, I basically say, whatever you want to experiment, you can. So that gives us an idea, and one day when we're ready to have a new product put in place, we kind of did the background work of it, and we just have to produce it.
And that was Paul Sutter, the master cheesemaker at Natural Pastures Cheese Company in Courtenay, British Columbia. I toured the facility in October 2008 along with delegates from the annual conference of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation. The interview segments with President Edgar Smith are courtesy of the Pursuit of Pleasure podcast produced by the Dairy Farmers of Canada at allyouneedischeese.ca. And the comedic segments were of actor John Cleese and his role with Monty Python. You're tuned in to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. If you miss any of today's broadcast or would like to explore archived episodes, you can listen to them online through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Also on the series of tours that conference delegates participated in was a trip to DKT Ranch, also in Courtenay. Owned and operated by Dan and Maggie Thran, DKT is an 80-acre farm which was purchased by Dan's parents in 1927. His parents turned it into a dairy farm in the early 1940s, and the farm was passed on to Danny in the early 1970s. Since then, the farm has primarily become a beef operation along with pasture-raised poultry, lamb, and eggs. But what separates this farm from others is how Dan and Maggie have saved the farm from the demise met by many other farms of similar size. Located just off of one of the area's major thoroughfares, the farm operates a small market store, where their meats and eggs are sold and where some of the vegetables and fruits grown on theirs and neighboring farms are also sold. The couple also produces a line of preserves that they sell in the store. Moving towards the back of the farm is another innovative revenue generator, two off-the-grid cabins that can be rented for either short or long stays. These efforts to diversify the farm is what is known as agritourism, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But first, let's look at some of the challenges that DKT Ranch faced and faces. In our recent July 2008 series titled Livestock Lost, we explored new meat inspection regulations in the province that have created incredible difficulty for small-scale farmers wishing to process their animals. While Dan is thankful that he has a processor nearby, the regulations have nevertheless increased their costs enormously.
What it's done, it's increased their costs just enormously. Just as an example, a steer that will dress out about 500 to 600 pounds will cost between $500 and $600 for processing. And that's just out-of-pocket expense. That's not anything that I have to, like I have to haul it for nothing. And that's just what it costs me. We done our herd bull the other day. The herd bull dressed out 1,369 pounds. We had it made into hamburger and sausage. And I just wrote a check last week for $1,200 for the processing of it. And so, you know, we have to get that $1,200 back, plus what the herd bull was worth if we shipped it to Vancouver, which may not have been worth that much, but you can see how the costs are there. And with that in mind, you know, the beef trade, well, people still eat beef, but they don't eat anywhere near what they used to eat, whether it's a health issue or whether it's a cost issue. But at the present time, we've cut back on our herd. That we used to have about 35 cows, now we're down to 15. And we can sell hay for horse people, which, you know, it pays the bills, but it doesn't necessarily do anything for next year. So those are some of the issues there.
Now, as a quick aside, I am compelled to play a clip here from British Columbia's Minister of Agriculture, Stan Hagen. Hagen spoke on two occasions throughout the course of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation conference, as his home in Riding was conveniently in the same location as the conference. Now, of course, it was the province who, in October 2007, implemented the new meat inspection regulations that in part led to the difficulties that farmers like Dan Thran now face. And so even though it's indisputable that the province's implementation of the regulation changes was flawed and has since dealt a strong blow to the availability of locally produced meat in the province, Minister Hagen chose DKT Ranch as an example of how he himself supports local food. Of course, the minister chose to not address the struggles that the Thrans and others are currently enduring.
I know you had a chance to get around to see a lot of the products that we produce this morning. I took some time and drove out to Danny Thran's turkey farm and ordered my fresh turkey for next weekend. And it was really, I enjoy going around to the farmers markets and to agriculture days around the province. It's such an important thing of what agriculture is about in the province because we're so diversified, as I mentioned last night.
British Columbia Minister of Agriculture, Stan Hagen. Now, while Dan and Maggie Thran continue to struggle with the challenges of keeping a small-scale farm afloat, delegates were invited into the farm's market store where the public is able to purchase their products. The Thrans are grateful for having diversified their operation to now manage this store because, as Dan told conference delegates, the health regulations at farmers' markets were hard to meet, and the store works around those concerns.
Anyway, welcome to our market. We built this market, we're in our sixth year of operation now, so I'd like to say it's working. You know, I think it's safe to say it's working. Now it just, with the real trend towards direct marketing and a lot of the consumers really picking up on that, now the real, it's not a problem, but the real effort has to be into maintain it, because now we're starting to find that we can't do enough farming to almost keep it going. You know, so what we do is we sell our beef, chicken, pork, our eggs, our canning our jams and jellies, our pickles, our squash, and then there's other things that we don't do, and we have, fortunately, we have a lot of people around here who are very adept or enjoy gardening, and they bring us product, fresh veggies every Friday, like, you know, starting today, they'll start petering or coming in tonight, and we only do local stuff, like very local,
except for the suckers,
and they come from New Brunswick, but they're to die for. And those are for the kids. So and some of the locals, they come and they will either, you know, we will buy their product off them, and then sell it here as their product, not as ours, or. In the case of one, Marcy and Jeff, who are from up Campbell River way, they have a fantastic love for gardening, and they bring us some of the best product you can ever think of. Eh? And people will line up for their product, and we swap. They take their beef and the chicken and the turkey and lamb, and we keep a running tab just like in the old days, and... Usually we owe them money because they have some really lovely product. And then we have a few crafts. We stay away a lot from the crafts because food is something that we need all the time. And so people come back all the time. And we find that if we just have good product for them, they'll be back. And so that's what's kept us going for 6 weeks. So if you got any questions, feel free.
So it's a real strong local returning market, like that's your clientele is
yep.
Where people get their vegetables.
We used to sell down the farmer's market, and then we got to the point where, you know, like we were selling beef at that point, and it's hard to pack down enough beef and to meet all the health regulations and everything, so we decided to go this route. And our market, the people that come to the market, in a lot of cases, they're from about, I'm going to say, from Courtney to Black Creek, you know, like a radius of about 6 kilometers, and they're our bread and butter. We do get people from the town, like from the cities, if you want to call Courtney a city, I guess, and from Comox, but, you know, once they find it, then, yeah, they do come and they support it, and it's been really good. And this is what I honestly think is going to keep us, like our farm is 80 acres that we own, and I think that that's what's going to keep the small farm going. Otherwise, I don't know.
Now, the market that the Thrans operate on their farm is only one of a number of options that the family has pursued to keep the farm in business. While agritourism is often looked down upon by many who believe that farms should be able to sustain themselves as farms, the Thrans recognized that clinging on to such principles would have spelled the end of farming. In this next segment, Dan Thran describes the two cabins that were constructed on the farm to accommodate overnight visitors. In the segment, Dan uses two acronyms, BSE, which is also known as mad cow disease, and ALR, which is in reference to British Columbia's Agricultural Land Reserve, a reserve that the Thrans farm is located within. When the Thrans chose to construct the cabins, the rules governing the ALR did not easily permit the construction of the cabins. And Dan Thran explains.
Over the last, like we went through BSE, and that was just a killer. I mean, you may as well have shot the cows and buried them kind of thing. And fortunately we had our cabins going, and we started in the early 90s, and Niels can contest to this, we fought with ALR. It wasn't considered farming at that time, and it wasn't agricultural use of the land. And we kind of done it anyway, and then we got it okayed, and that really helped. And now, the nice thing is it's low up maintenance cost on that, so the income from that is generally a lot more than, you know.
Just what share of revenue?
I would say 40% of our revenue comes from those two cabins.
But far more than 40% of your profit?
Like it's yeah, I would say probably close to 80% of our profit because, you know, our inputs are so large on everything on the farm aspect.
Are other farmers coming here to see what you're doing and are inspired to do the same?
Well, some do and some don't. Some won't grace and I'm being honest here, some won't grace it because agritourism wasn't one thing that a lot of people... I can remember we had a field, a farm day here back in the early 90s. And at that point, we had people from all over Vancouver Island here. And some of them thought that agritourism is not a farming thing. Like, you're not a farmer if you got agritourism. Farmers raise cattle, they chickens, whatever. And so there, some people aren't in favor. And that's the truth.
Too short-sighted.
Well, yeah. I don't know if they're still in business either.
Yeah.
20 years ago, when I started with cattle, I would never have dreamt of having a sheep on the place. That was the furthest thought from my mind. And I never ever thought of having a log cabin and that someone from the city would just love to be able to light a fire, and whether it's sit outside next to a fire or no TV, no phone. And, you know, and the safety element was we're close enough to town that they feel secure enough, but yet they feel like they're really, really roughing it. And I never thought we'd ever be doing that. And so it's evolved. You know, I think our main concern is to be able to pass it on as a going concern, you know, and be able to keep it as a farm. And Niels may not like this, but I just got to throw this in. And this is, I agree with the ALR in principle, but I think it needs to be revisited.
We need to make it work.
And yeah. And I think the Swiss cheese effect would really be good. And I'll leave it at that. Sorry, Niels.
What exactly should be changed?
Well, no, today's not the day to go ahead. There's lots that can be said.
Put your tape recorders away.
But anyway, would you like, I know it's raining, but we can't get the bus down to where the cabins are. So if you'd like to go for a walk, it's about a 5-minute walk. And we can do that, and it goes down the farm.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and a recording from an October 2008 visit to DKT Ranch, a small-scale mixed farm located in Courtenay, British Columbia. Dan and Maggie Thran hosted delegates from the Conference of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation and shared with them how they have chosen to diversify their farm in order to stay in business.
Are we all here?
I think so.
Yep.
Okay, well, I got to tell you about, this is called the bunkhouse. The log cabin is under the trees behind the sheep over there.
Okay.
The important part about, there's lots of important parts, but one of the important parts of where the cabins are is that it's the environmental footprint. They do not subtract or detract from our farming enterprise. We use the same laneway to haul hay. We use the same laneway to chase the cows up. And that was really important to, you know, our land commission and to myself as well. The cabins are also situated so that you can't see one another, so it gives a lot of privacy. They're also situated so you get a decent view of the mountains when it's not raining.
Yes.
And the last thing is they're solar powered, and they are, the heat is wood heat, and the hot water is a demand hot water system, so they're very efficient in that respect. And before we put the demand hot water in, I gotta tell you this, we'd have people staying in the cabin. And they wouldn't have a shower for about 4 days because they didn't want to run the generator to heat the water because that wasn't environmentally friendly. So people, if they're given the option, they will really go out. And now we ran out of power once in this cabin. And that was when we had a family of seven in here for a week over Christmas. And Granny used the hair curler. And at that point, we ran out of power a little bit. But other than that, people are very, very conscious about power, so it's a good tool for them to learn. And we've had to show people how to light fires, so we've become quite removed from out in the country, you might say.
Did you build it yourself?
This cabin here, I traded $600 worth of hay for the logs. Mm-hmm. We pulled them out of the neighbors, and we peeled them. And we built the cabin. All the inside, other than the countertop and the toilet, is recycled.
Yeah.
And the bedding, of course. So it's all recycled. Same with the windows, they're all recycled. as I was saying on the way down, when we built the cabins, we actually were really kind of scared because we didn't want to turn it into a hotel motel business. We wanted to stay a farm. And so we didn't want to be busy every night. We didn't want to be washing and changing sheets. It was like I told that one guy on our in the DA when we had the tourists and they built the cat when they, and the guys, some people weren't that happy that this was an agricultural thing. And I told them like it took me less time to change sheets on the bed than it did to slaughter a steer. And that's still the truth, you know.
And that was Dan Thran of DKT Ranch in Courtney, British Columbia. A link to the farm's website will be posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website under the December 11th, 2008 broadcast. And to round off today's diverse broadcast, we'll leave Vancouver Island and head down the Strait of Georgia to Salt Spring Island, home to the Salt Spring Island Apple Festival. The island's apple history dates back to 1860, and the island is now said to be home to over 350 varieties that are being grown organically. Correspondent Andrea Langlois took a trip to the island in September to meet with festival organizer Harry Burton. Harry is a farmer at Apple Luscious Organic Orchard, where he grows 23 varieties of red-fleshed apples, a unique apple that has somewhat of a cultish status among those who know about them. According to an article by Ram Fishman, the red-fleshed apple's origin is undocumented, but is suggested to have originated in what is now Turkestan. Red-fleshed apples were reported growing in the London Horticulture Society's gardens around 1830 and became known in England and later North America as the surprise apple. The apple is said to have arrived in the United States in 1840. Some of the varieties of the apples are named Hull's Pink, Almada, Pink Pearl, Burgundy, Mott's Pink, Webster's Pink Meat, and Baldwin Red Flesh, among others.
I'm Harry Burton, and my wife and I run the festival. We organize it, and we're one of the participating orchards in the festival. I guess it was sort of taken from a few ideas they were running down in California up in the mountains where they have festivals, and we said, gee, we need a festival here. It's a perfect way to connect people with apples. And so we started in 99. Probably the main goal is to get people excited about apples again, because apples are something they should be excited about, but they've been sort of brainwashed into thinking apples are pretty boring. So we tend to try to reverse that trend by giving them exciting apples.
And how many visitors are you expecting?
Last year we had 700, and it was an awful, rainy, miserable day, so we're hoping for something better than that.
The theme of this year is the red-fleshed apples. I think most people don't even know that red-fleshed apples exist. Could you comment on that?
Red-fleshed apples are the apples of the future. I had people, a little old woman from Vancouver calling me wanting to know where she could get them. She called every store there. They are a marketer's dream because they're incredible tasting. They look good. They're good for you. And we haven't even talked about the Chinese market, where red is an incredibly important Chinese color.
Most people, if you ask them to name a few apples, they would maybe name Gala, Macintosh. It seems like there's heritage varieties, you know, that are being introduced or that people can taste here today. And the heirloom tomato market has kind of exploded over the last year. Do you think that that's what might happen for apples?
Definitely, yeah. It is happening. It's part of the trend there for all these varieties of apples. We had 309 varieties on display at Fulford, all grown on Salt Spring. So that was pretty incredible. And all grown organically as well.
What's the benefit of having such a diversity of apples? How many, maybe you could start by saying how many different varieties of trees you have in the orchard we're standing in right now.
Yeah, this orchard has 200 varieties plus, and all sorts of values. Number one, you never have to worry about pollination because there's always something here to cross-pollinate. Number two, you've got apples all the way from August through to November, and you've got apples to cover every niche. And so one of the very important things about sort of marketing apples now is diversity. You give people a real diversity. The Okanagan is trying to sell one apple right now. They're trying to sell ambrosia as if it's going to save them, and one apple isn't going to save anybody. So people want diversity. They want all the different apples.
And your orchard here, I've noticed it doesn't quite look like the orchard so someone might picture. Could you maybe draw a picture for our listeners of your type of growing?
Well, we call this a wild orchard. We mow in February, so everything gets mowed down in February, and then we let it grow up, and the rule is it can't touch the tree. So we keep the vegetation back from the tree, but what we've got here is 6-foot-high blackberries, and it's an incredibly important way to grow because the soil is shaded from the sun. All the leaves collect the dew every morning. I can still see dew on this, and it's almost noon now. For insects, it provides an incredible diversity of insect habitat. Ladybugs, for instance, love the stinging nettle, which is right in there. And so, again, it helps give you a wide population of insects. All that, when it gets mowed, goes back into the soil. So it's almost like it's an obvious, you know.
If I was to do one thing today on my apple tour, what should I do?
Enjoy apples. Taste all you can. Taste every apple you can.
It's early up Ontario farm. Chicken crow for day. I wish I grew Annapolis apples up above Fundy's Bay. Oh, it seems so far away. Ridge above Acadia's town to the valley down below. The evening shadow falls upon the families listening to the radio and watching the apples grow. Down on the farm back among the family, away from a tear, I yo. Hear the ladies singing to the men, dancing at heel and toe, and watching the apples grow. I've seen the place I'd rather be. Your scummy lakes in the city of Toronto don't do a damn thing for me. I'd rather live by the sea. I've watched the bees and geese go by the Foxfoot in the snow. I've climbed the ridge of Gaspereau Mountain, looking to the valley below, and watching the apples grow. Down on the farm, back among the family, away from a tear, I go. Hear the ladies singing to the men, dancing at heel and toe, and watching the apples grow. Singing to the men, dancing at heel and toe, and watching the apples grow. Sit down on the farm back among the family, away from a tear, I go. Hear the ladies singing to the men, dancing at heel and toe, and watching the apples grow.
The late Stan Rogers and his tune, Watching the Apples Grow. Stan Rogers was born in Hamilton, Ontario, and later grew up in Nova Scotia. That last segment featured correspondent Andrea Langlois as she visited the September 2008 Salt Spring Island Apple Festival. Andrea spoke with Harry Burton of Apple Luscious Organic Orchard. More information on red-fleshed apples will be linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.